This week we are studying 1 Samuel 2, 1 through 10. Herein we have Hannah's praise to God for the birth of her son Samuel. In it she praises God for his power and his willingness to use his power to intervene on behalf of the weak. Hannah's prayer will give us occasion to consider the nature of justice and God's intervention into human affairs, and we will also find here the first mention of the Messiah, which will become an important theme in the Bible. So then your passage for consideration is 1 Samuel 2, 1 through 10, and if you haven't read it yet, I recommend that you pause and read it now. Today's passage follows 1 Samuel chapter 1. There, Hannah, a barren woman, had been taunted for her reproductive difficulties and had prayed for a son whom she received. In chapter 2, then, Hannah rejoices, and in rejoicing, she gives her reason why, explaining to us some important principles about God's power, his intervention into human affairs, and his purpose in doing so for the cause of justice. So in the opening verse, Hannah rejoices. She says that her rejoicing is done in Jehovah because of his salvation. So Jehovah saved her from bad circumstances, and for that she praises him. She listed three results from his intervention. First, that her heart exulted or rejoiced. She was very happy. Second, that her horn was exalted. Now, obviously, we're getting into some poetic imagery here. Hannah did not have horns. Figuratively, this means that she is strong, like a bull with horns. Hannah had felt weak and powerless without a horn, but with God's help, her circumstances had changed, and she felt strong. The third result was that her mouth derided her enemies. Hannah had been an object of mockery, but the one who laughs last laughs loudest. She now had a retort for her rival who had teased her. Hannah had been weak and despairing and mocked, but now she was joyful, powerful, and speaking back, because God had given her what she requested. This leads us to a descriptor of God who had helped her. Hannah first pointed out how God is different from everything else. She said that there is none holy like Jehovah. To be holy is to be set apart, different from other things. God is unique and greater than all the other things. There is no one beside him. None can compare. And God is not uniquely set apart in that he is particularly malevolent or impotent. No, God is set apart in that he is to be compared to the rock. This is a fairly common descriptor of God. We saw it recently in our study of Psalm 144, published on February 7th of 2021. The rock is a place of strength. In battle, it is the high place, easy to defend. It is a solid place of sure footing. It is the foundation for building. So here, God is said to be set apart as unique in his strength and his benefit to humanity. If we skip down to verse 8, we read that God is of such strength that he laid the very foundations of the earth and set the earth on its pillars. Now, obviously, we're reading another poetic descriptor here. Just as God is not literally a rock, so the world is not literally sitting on pillars. The point is that Jehovah, God of the universe, is unique in that he alone is all-powerful. There is no rock stronger, there is no foundation surer. Only God founded the world. So then, in verse 3, Hannah warned her mocking rivals, and indeed us, that we should no longer allow proud and arrogant talk to come from our mouths. And how could we? How could we lift ourselves up as if we are great when we are to be held in comparison to the God who laid the foundations of the world? Seeing also that God knows our thoughts and our words and our actions, and knowing that he ultimately will judge our actions, we should certainly not act out of turn by arrogantly mocking the weak, as had happened in Hannah's case. And indeed, as Hannah said, God's judgment does come, even in the short term, because God does intervene in human affairs. Particularly, Hannah emphasized God's actions in making the strong weak and the weak strong. She gave several poetic descriptors of this, examples including, most pertinently, the barren woman bearing many children, while the woman with many children is forlorn or exhausted, in this case meaning that she ceases to bear. Hannah refers to the weak having strength in battle while the weapons of the mighty break, and to those who had been poor and hungry having plenty, while those who had been full hired themselves out for something to eat. To go down a side trail here, we note that the person who felt the need to hire himself out to others, acting as an employee to buy bread, was considered a poor person. A person of any means would have a piece of ground on which he could plant enough food to sustain himself, and thus would not hire himself out. As we have noted before, a person in modern Western society is counted lucky if he can own a roof over his head and can feed himself without being deeply in debt. One 2018 survey found that 44% of Americans expected to have a mortgage at 65 when they planned to retire. See a link to that data in the library. Seeing that such is the case, I think we err when we presume that our people in general are wealthier than people were in former times. I also think we err if we think that we are more free than they were. Wealth gives a person freedom. A person who depends on another for his food must conform his behavior to the wishes of the person on whom he depends. A farmer who grows his own food can do what he wants. He is free to honor God with his life. An employee who works for someone else is pressured to conform to the standards of his employer and to the world. But that's an aside. We're talking about examples of people whom God makes weak and strong. God can switch the poor for the rich. He can make high the lowly. He can raise to life from the grave or bring the live to the grave. Indeed, he can take a poor person out of the dust and sit him up among the princes, and in some cases he does. Now, all of that taken from context might have the ring of class warfare to it. We might wrongly perceive that God has some kind of opposition to a person who is living, wealthy, healthy, and powerful, while having an affinity for the weak, sick, poor, and dead. Of course, that wouldn't make much sense anyway. As soon as he raised the poor person to riches, it seems like he would suddenly hate that one and want to drag him back down again. Thankfully, the passage describes for us that there is a general pattern to how God does this. God doesn't judge by circumstances, rather he deals out circumstances according to good judgment. It is justice that God deals in. In the final verses of the psalm, we read that God cuts down the wicked, leaving them in darkness, but that he guards those who are faithful to him. We note here that God is the ultimate standard of truth. He is the standard of what is right and what is wrong. Faithfulness to God, then, is the measure of a person's goodness, and opposition to God is the measure of his wickedness. And it is by this standard alone that justice can be measured. By this standard, God judges to the ends of the earth, dashing his adversaries to pieces and strengthening his faithful. And in the second half of that last verse, we have something very interesting, a reference which makes this passage a prediction of things to come. Hannah said here that God will, that being future for her, not past or present, will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. And this must have been a prediction of future events. At that time there was no king in Israel, and there had not been prior, nor was there any anointed one. That word anointed in English translates the Hebrew word Messiah, and it is going to be an important word, so let's give it its due consideration. Ceremonially speaking, a person would be anointed when a person of authority poured a holy anointing oil on him. In general, an anointed person is one who has been set apart, consecrated, and made holy for special service to God. A priest could be termed an anointed. More specifically, and in the primary usage, the anointed refers to the person set apart as king over Israel, and that, of course, is the context that Hannah used here. There would be many messiahs in Israel's history. As this book of 1 Samuel will tell, Saul was the first anointed king. David referred to him as Messiah many times. David also was anointed king, and so were his descendants after him. Any one of them could rightly be called a messiah, and this prophetic utterance looks forward to those kings. However, biblical prophecy tends to have a certain telescoping aspect. Often, prophecies in the Bible will have an immediate application, as well as a distant future application. A famous example of this is Isaiah 7:14. There, Isaiah said that a virgin would conceive and bear a son and would call his name Emmanuel. Well, when Isaiah first said this, he spoke it to King Ahaz as something that would be fulfilled in their own lifetimes, that a girl who was at that time a virgin would, through normal relations, conceive and bear a child, and that this would happen before a certain prophesied historical event. However, Matthew cited this as being a prophecy of the Immaculate Conception of Christ by the Virgin Mary hundreds of years later. So the prophecy had two meanings, one immediate and practical, and one far off, referring to Christ. That is also the case here, because while Hannah was prophesying that, given the context, through the work of her son Samuel, there would come a line of kings backed by God, she was also giving a prophecy concerning the Anointed One, not just a Messiah, but the Messiah, the King, Jesus. At the time when Jesus came into the world, some thousand years after the events discussed today, the Jews were desperate for a king or Messiah who was expected to rescue them from the Romans. What they got was a Messiah who would rescue the entire world from sin. This prophecy of Hannah's points forward to him as the one who will judge the ends of the earth and who will reign exalted and in strength. It appears that Zechariah, a priest and father of John the Baptist, living in the generation just prior to Jesus, referenced Hannah's song when John was born and while Mary was pregnant with Jesus. In his prophecy, recorded in Luke 1, Zechariah proclaimed that John would go before the Lord to prepare his ways. The reference to 1 Samuel is found in verses 68 through 70 of Luke chapter 1, where Zechariah said, quote, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people and has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets from of old." Of note, Jesus is commonly called Christ. Christ is the Greek translation of the word Messiah. So when we say Jesus Christ, we are saying Jesus the Messiah, the Anointed One. So that terminology all started here in 1 Samuel 2. Let's dig into some practical application of the passage. First, I want us to note plainly here that might does not make right. I'm not going to dig deeply into this because it is a topic that we have considered many times in the past, but I do want to touch on it because it's here. Hannah here said that God would punish the wicked and rescue the good. This is justice, and she depicts God's justice specifically against the powerful and on behalf of the weak. The very concept of justice tells us that there is a definitive moral right and wrong. God is the standard of right and wrong, and God will ultimately judge the good from the bad. Whether or not a person has the temporal power to get away with an action has no bearing on whether or not that action is morally acceptable in the sight of God. And so we see it here. Hannah depicts people of power, people who can temporarily get away with doing evil, as being laid low by the ultimate power of God. So let us remember that might does not make right. Only conformity to God's standards makes right. Second, I want us to note that God has power to change our circumstances, and thus, whatever circumstances we have, they are the circumstances God has given us. God is in control. He works for a higher purpose than our purposes, and that purpose is His ultimate glory. Our lives are one small piece of a much grander picture. That is not to say that God does not work for our ultimate best benefit. It may not always look like that to us, but we cannot possibly know all of the variables affecting all of the circumstances of our lives. We may be able to conceive some hypothetical situation which we think would be better for us than the circumstances that we have, but that doesn't mean that situation would actually be the best circumstance. And frankly, no matter how good our circumstances are, we will always be able to conceive of something hypothetically better. There's always one more dollar you could add to your bank account. It is best for us then to find contentment in the circumstances that we have. We should trust that God cares for our best interest and that He has given us that which is actually in our best interest, even if it is difficult for us to understand how. We should learn to be thankful for the blessings we have instead of only focusing on the things that we don't have. And we should remember that even the things we have, we don't deserve. What we deserve as sinners fallen short of God is punishment and not any blessing at all. And knowing the 10th commandment, "You shall not covet," we should train ourselves to be glad for what we have rather than to desire what others have. That does not mean that we should not pray for better when our circumstances don't match our ideal. Obviously, Hannah did that. But it does mean that we should take comfort in knowing that God is in control. And we should remember that when circumstances are hard, God can change them. This passage speaks repeatedly to God's ability to raise up the lowly and of His willingness to do so. When times are hard, we should not be afraid to cry out to God and to trust Him to give us better. However, we also should be cautious not to expect to get blessings if we are not living well. God is a God of justice. We do not see here that God gives out anything that anyone asks for without any condition. Particularly when we compare to Hannah's situation, we find that she had to be willing to make major sacrifices for God before she got what she wanted. We should not call on God and ask Him to give us what we want and then stubbornly fight against Him when He tells us what to do. To make a quick example, maybe you want a new car. Maybe you need a new car. You might ask God for it. But what God gives you are strong hands to work and a good mind to think instead of a car. And he tells you in his word not to be lazy, but to go to work. And if you were to do that, you could work and earn some money and then you could get the car. But in the alternative, if you decide to be disobedient and lazy, well, then you won't make the money and you won't get the car. Sometimes obedience to God is the avenue by which he gives you the thing that you seek. But for those who will turn against God, we see here that God will work against them. God's power is a coin with two sides. Just as he can lift you up, so he can bring you down. With that in mind, my recommendation to you is that you ask for his blessing, and not only that, but that you also ensure that your life is conformed to his standards so that you can receive that blessing rather than receiving his wrath. To conclude then, 1 Samuel 2, 1-10 contains Hannah's praise to God after the birth of her son Samuel. In her praise, she noted God's power and his willingness to use it, providing several examples of how a person can be either raised up from lowliness to greatness or vice versa. This gave us cause to consider God's ability to intervene in our own lives, either for good or for bad, and to consider his just nature in doing so. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.